May some saving sense of humor liberate us. For allowing ourselves to ridicule the faith of others, may we be forgiven. From making it war and calling it peace, social privilege and calling it justice, indifference and calling it tolerance, pollution and calling it progress, may we be cured. For telling ourselves that evil is inevitable while good is impossible, may we stand corrected. God of our mixed up, tragic, aspiring, doubting, and insurgent lives, help us to be as good as, in our hearts, we have always wanted to be. Amen. And our second reading this morning is the poem Wild Geese by Mary Oliver. You do not have to be good. You do not have to walk on your knees for 100 miles through the desert, repenting. You only have to let the soft animal of your body love what it loves. Tell me about despair, yours, and I will tell you mine. Meanwhile, the world goes on. Meanwhile, the sun and the clear pebbles of the rain are moving across the landscapes, over the prairies and the deep trees, the mountains and the rivers. Meanwhile, the wild geese, high in the clean blue air, are heading home again. Whoever you are, no matter how lonely, the world offers itself to your imagination, calls to you like the wild geese, harsh and exciting, over and over announcing your place in the family of things. In seminary, I took a class called Systematic Theology. Because, you know, theology is easily systematized. Anyway, one day we were introduced to a particular theological controversy that took place somewhere around 300 AD. This controversy involved the theologians Pelagius and Augustine, and it involved the nature of sin and forgiveness. Now, Pelagius argued for an extremely narrow definition of sin. In order for something to be a sin, according to Pelagius, you had to, one, break a commandment of God. You had to know that you were breaking a commandment of God. And you had to intend to be breaking a commandment of God. In other words, if you were overcome with emotion and had no clear intent, or if you had never been taught the commandments of God, or if any other number of extenuating circumstances were present, it didn't count as a sin. But Pelagius also believed that real sins that followed this definition could only be forgiven once, and that was in the rite of baptism. If you committed a sin after you were baptized, you would go to hell. This theology, among other things, led to a lot of deathbed baptisms, as one logical way to deal with this belief is to put off that one chance of forgiveness for as long as possible. Of course, if you wait too long, you're out of luck. Now, Augustine, on the other hand, argued that almost everything was a sin. He believed that people could, and very often did, sin without meaning to, and without knowing they were sinning. On the other hand, Augustine believed that forgiveness was always available. It wasn't a once-in-a-lifetime thing. Divine forgiveness could be sought and would be granted at any time. Now, personally, I'm not a huge fan of Augustine. Some of his ideas, especially his ideas about human sexuality, have been incredibly harmful in the life of the Christian church and in the societies that have influenced. But in this debate between Pelagius and Augustine, I am squarely on Augustine's side. Whether we use the term sin or not, I think it's important to acknowledge the ways we cause harm that are unintentional. I think it's important to see clearly the ways we've missed the mark and to take responsibility for the impact of our actions and not just for our intent. And I also believe that forgiveness is always possible. That the stores of the divine grace never run dry, that it is never too late to seek forgiveness and never too late for forgiveness to be offered. The central tenet of universalist faith and the theology that gave the movement its name was the idea of universal salvation. In other words, to the universalists, divine forgiveness is not only always available, it is, in fact, inevitable. As 19th century universalist minister Olympia Brown put it, universalists believe in a God who will ultimately bring every wandering soul home, reconciled and confirmed in the good. Or, as another 19th century universalist minister and former minister of this congregation, Quillen Shin, said, quote, "Oh, the vision of universalism. It is great and grand beyond compare. It sees the searchlight of eternal love breaking from the throne of God. It streams down the avenues of eternity. It flashes into all the dark abysses of the universe. The face of the last wayward child turns homeward. Repentant and radiant with hope, he comes to the Father's house. So love is all conquering." End quote. Last week, I talked about forgiving others, the work of forgiving others. And as hard as it can be to forgive those who have hurt us, it can be harder still to receive forgiveness when it is offered. And perhaps, hardest of all, to forgive ourselves. Lewis Smedes, who I quoted from a lot last week, tells a story in his book, Forgive and Forget. He had an old friend who he had not seen in some time. This friend came to him one day to ask Smedes for forgiveness for some wrong the friend had committed quite some time ago. Smedes' friend was clearly in distress about having done this harm, but Smedes himself, had no memory of the event in question. He had already forgiven his friend and forgotten about the whole thing. A few years ago, I was preaching about forgiveness, and during discussion time, someone truthfully told us that she had been avoiding a particular member of the congregation because the speaker, the one telling this story, owed that person something from a church auction years ago that had never been delivered. She apologized deeply and sincerely. The other person had also forgotten all about it and was by no means angry or resentful, which is a good thing because there's a lot of outstanding auction items. Some of our mistakes, our missing of the mark, is like this. It is huge to us, but small to the ones we have wronged. For us, it takes on a life of its own and continues to torment us. To them, it passes quickly and is soon forgiven. But some of our mistakes, of course, are not so easily set aside. Sometimes we have, in fact, caused real and lasting harm. There is a sorrow of the heart when we know we have caused harm, disappointed someone, or betrayed a trust. This is why we say, "I'm sorry." There is a deep sorrow that comes when we look at the ways we have hurt others. For this reason, some people never look. Some people turn away from the ways they have caused harm. But this only compounds the harm and keeps us frozen and locked up inside. Others can't look away. That sorrow grabs and holds on and becomes all that we can see. And sometimes that paralyzes us and makes us cut ourselves off from the restoration and reconciliation that may be possible. And sometimes we gather our tattered courage and our sorrowful hearts, and we go to the one we have harmed, and we try to undo as much of that harm as we can, and we ask for forgiveness. Sometimes it is offered, and sometimes it isn't. But we still have to go on, and so we must find a way to know ourselves forgiven and to forgive ourselves. For those who follow the 12 steps of Alcoholics Anonymous or its related programs, step 5 is, we admitted to God, to ourselves, and to another human being the exact nature of our wrongs. Often that other person is one's sponsor, but sometimes someone in AA or another 12-step program would prefer to speak to a clergy person. And so a few times, I have been the other human being to whom someone has told the story of the wrongs they have committed. One of these stories stands out in my memory. The details of the story, of course, belong to the person who told it to me, and are not mine to tell. But what struck me about the encounter was the other person's lightness of spirit after she had finished. She had told me this heart-wrenching story, but she had also freed herself from it, at least in part. In the telling, she had set it aside and had determined to move forward. She took responsibility for the wrongs she had done and knew that further down the line, she would make what amends she could for those wrongs. But she also knew that these wrongs were not the center of her identity. She was becoming a new person, and these mistakes did not define her anymore, if indeed they ever had. It was a beautiful thing to watch, and I felt deeply privileged to witness to it. What we seek is not what has been called cheap grace, forgiveness without real regret and without amends, restitution, or seeking to mitigate harm. What we seek is the forgiveness that comes when we have done all we could to make amends, and then we allow ourselves to feel the grace of forgiveness. I said last week that forgiveness does not necessarily mean reconciliation. And that is true when we are talking about one person forgiving another person. If I have been wronged, I can offer forgiveness without necessarily reestablishing a relationship that seems incapable of being more life-giving. But when we are talking about forgiving ourselves, I think that reconciliation is a part of the process. We reconcile, we come back into relationship with ourselves. When we are sorrowful after some wrong we have committed and we are angry with ourselves, when we withhold grace and forgiveness from ourselves and offer to our inner being only judgment and criticism, we are, in a sense, split. We have cut off some part of ourselves deemed evil or bad or unworthy or unlovable. And so the act of forgiving ourselves is an act of reconciliation, of opening doors that have been slammed shut between the different aspects of our beings. We welcome our whole self back into grace and love and relationship. Now, each of us will have a different idea about what receiving forgiveness looks like, depending on our theology. For some, forgiveness is a gift of God or the goddess. For some, forgiveness is offered by the larger world. For some, forgiveness is a matter of the human heart. But for any of these to have effect, for any of us, regardless of theology, to receive forgiveness requires a moment of opening. Opening to divine grace, opening to the love of the world around us, opening to each other, opening to ourselves. Opening to the soft, gentle coming of love. Come, come, whoever you are, Rumi says, though you've broken your vows 1,000 times, come. You do not have to be good, Mary Oliver assures us. The geese will announce your place in the family of things, regardless. What does it take to let that message in? What does it take to feel the soft, gentle coming of love? What does it take to allow grace into our lives and our hearts? It takes a pause, an opening, a release of walls and barriers. Let us then pause for a moment, and in the anonymous words from the hymnal, let us open our minds and hearts to the place of quiet, to the silent prayer for the healing of pain and the soft, gentle coming of love. I invite you into a time of silence. find the courage to witness to our own shortcomings. May we find the strength to make what amends we can. May we find the grace to forgive ourselves. And may we offer healing and love to ourselves, to each other, and to the world. Amen. I invite you now into a time of reflection and discussion together.
As a lawyer, I run across two very different ways people deal with mistakes. I mean, these aren't the only two, but for contrast, some people will come in and say, I made this horrible mistake, not necessarily in those words. So they're certainly acknowledging that they goofed up somewhere. And I don't think it's my role to ask them whether they're forgiving themselves or not. That's more Erica's role. But the other kind, with which we have to be very careful to distinguish, are people who say, I'm not the sort of person who does that sort of thing, and therefore it never happened.
Thank you. I was thinking in similar lines to what Herb is. I've got two brothers that have faced similar issues in their lives. One brother, he's accepted the responsibility for what problems have happened, and I very much respect him. At the same time, I feel bad for him because he's having a hard time letting it go. On the other side, I have a brother who is always someone else's fault. You know, someone he's always had bad bosses, his money problems, or somebody else's problems, and that's problem as well. I mean, it's quite an interesting contrast. Thank you.
You forgive, but you can't forget. So you move on that way. So I said, especially about me.
I find that the hardest thing to do if you're in a position of authority in a classroom and you've misjudged a student's work, because you're supposed to be the authority and everything you say comes directly from God or strength of God, if you've ever used that grammar book. That's exceedingly hard, and I'm still beating myself up. One or two times I've sucked it in and done it, but boy, probably a million times, and I just did not have the backbone.
Thank you.
I think last week you said something about, you know that you've forgiven a person if you wish them well. And it's easy to wish myself well. So I must have forgiven myself for anything that I might have ever done. But, you know, I often think that I have forgiven somebody that I feel like has really been doing me wrong in a severe way. And I do all the things that I'm supposed to do to forgive them, and I think I have. And then I realize I don't wish them well. Wish them well at all. There are times when maybe I might wish them well, occasionally, once, you know, for a second or two, but I seem to be really lost when it comes to really and truly constantly wishing that person well if they really wronged me. And I wonder if you have an answer to what I can do, because I do want to. I really do.
So last week I also said that real forgiveness sometimes has to be done over and over again, right? So I think this is a perfect illustration that those moments of wishing the other, seconds of wishing the other person well, are real, real forgiveness. And then we lose it again, we pick up the coal again, right? And then we have to do it again. So it's a continuous process. And I think that sometimes forgiving ourselves is like that too. Like, if I have done something, I can sometimes let it go for a little while, but then it will come back, and you'll have to do that process all over again. So, yeah, thank you. And I guess.
I read a quote recently, I wish I could remember who said it, but it was that when another person causes you suffering, it is because they are suffering even more, and it's spilling out onto you. They don't need permission, they need help. And as hard as that is to put into practice, that actually helped me when someone is being unkind to me and I can remember it's because they are feeling so awful. And then it's a little easier to forgive them.
Thank you.
The most amazing story of forgiveness that I remember, and Ann and I went to a service in West Hartford, Connecticut, some years ago. We saw this minister speak, whose oldest son was murdered, his college-age son, and his son was murdered in a drug deal. And he was, of course, beside himself. And he went to these support groups. I'm sorry, I can't remember his name. He goes around speaking now. He went to the support groups and saw people who were still, after years and years, still eaten up by anger over losing someone to a crime or murder. And he said, I can't do this. And he ended up writing a letter to his son's murderer. He was able to communicate with him, wrote a letter to him. He ended up going to the jail, meeting the guy who said, you know, I was a different person then. I was in drugs. He says, I'm really sorry about this. And he ended up corresponding with him regularly. And he said, eventually forgiving him. And he said that saved his life from a life of anger, and it saved the other man's life, his son's murderer, because he was actually able to get out of jail. The minister lobbied for his parole and ended up being the minister at his wedding. Is that an ultimate tale of forgiveness?
Thank you.
He said it saved two more lives.
Thank you.
Rebecca's comments reminded me of a movie that Emily and I watched Friday night. It was on video. It's not a great movie, but
it's Snowman? No.
Snow White and the Huntsman. And I recommended for The Evil Queen. It's so, Charlize Theron is the actress, and she does a great job of showing evil, but also the utter tragedy of her hatred and her evil.
I think one thing that helps people in forgiving someone for a very deep wound is when the person who was harmed works toward feeling whole again, and then that can lead to forgiveness.
Thank
you. I don't have a whole lot to say. I just wanted to say that I thought the idea of opening was a really good word to describe what we have to do to stop from keeping hard feelings locked and shut away in darkness.
Thank you.
In those moments when I think about how difficult it is to forgive somebody. I think it must have been about if anybody, if he could do it, then anything I have would be wrong.
Thank you.
Thank you, everyone. We're going to sing closing hymn number 213. There's a wideness in your mercy. Please stand and embody your spirit.